Welcome to SDI Encounters, a podcast from Spiritual Directors International. I'm Matt Whitney. Thank you so much for listening. I offer a heartfelt welcome to new listeners and a welcome back to existing subscribers. If you like this show, please do click on the subscribe button. Here we offer a wide range of perspectives, stories, and conversations centered around community, spiritual companionship, and spiritual care. You'll find additional information, including videos, webinars, and digital publications at our website, sdiworld.org. Before we get into this week's episode, did you know that Spiritual Directors International organizes travel experiences? We call these SDI Journeys. SDI has been leading passionate travelers on spiritual journeys around the world for over 25 years. Not just vacations, but truly exceptional trips filled with inspiring and enriching experiences. We have upcoming journeys planned in Scotland, New Mexico, Bhutan and Nepal, and Australia. Explore our Journeys website to find out more. SDIJourneys.org. That's SDIJourneys.org. Karen Lee Ehrlichman provides psychotherapy, spiritual direction, and mentoring in San Francisco, integrating spiritual practices and body-centered resources to support healing. This episode is part two of my conversation with Karen. In part one from last week, Karen shared her personal story and how she discerned vocational calling. How do we define the work that we do, particularly when so many of us do many different things that weave the fabric of our lives? Some things for a paycheck or unpaid labor, or things that we do out of love and service as a friend, companion, or family member. It's interesting to hear Karen describe her journey as hybrid, a phenomenon of discerning that one's true identity is fluid and moves into, out of, and between many various categories and vocations without being pinned down into any of them.
I want to go back to your own journey. I'm thinking now of when you're looking through the career book, right? The A to Z, like, this is what I want to do. And this is the schooling I need, or this is the rabbinic path that I need to go on. And this is the title and this is the credential. And you talked about, you know, as you achieve each of those things, I suppose, you know, it's tempting to just like get into what you call the credential privilege, just like, look at all these acronyms after my name kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Like, let's just add some more. But I hear from you that like, that is leading you. It's the work underneath all of that, that is calling you. And so it wasn't any one of those things that satisfied you sort of in terms of how you felt called. I did this piece of schooling and then I got that degree, but that was not it. Or maybe that was just a small part of it. And then I do this other thing. And now Karen wears all these different hats. What are you?
I ask myself that every day. You know, it's interesting because in some ways I don't experience them internally as separate. And even though people do say to me a lot, similar to what you just said, you do a lot of things, I feel them inside myself very integrated. Like energetically, my communication style or just like my presence in the room or in relationship with people is, I think in my own personal journey, I am at a place right now where I feel like I'm myself in all of those places in slightly different ways. Like the paradigm in therapy is a little bit different. It's, I am not sharing as much personal information as I might in another setting as a teacher or as a spiritual director or a supervisor, because that's not the purpose of being there. I mean, occasionally there are things that come up where I might share something, if only by necessity. But what's important to me is that whatever it is that I'm doing, either as a teacher or a spiritual director or a therapist, or just like a citizen of the world, that people have a sense like, I am who I am, like what you see is what you get, you know, like that authenticity. And I spent a lot of my life, I think, not knowing how to do that or not feeling safe doing that for a variety of different reasons. And so even my therapy clients, my most traditional therapy clients, will say, well, I don't really know that much about Karen, but I feel like she's real with me. You know, it's like that feeling. Yeah. And, you know, you can tell when somebody's being real most of the time and when somebody's like, you know, blowing smoke and mirrors at you. And so there's a certain kind of, it's a collaborative partnership in a particular context. So for example, I do ask my therapy clients, like when I'm first meeting somebody and doing like an initial conversation with them, you know, you ask people intensely personal questions at the beginning of psychotherapy about abuse and, you know, addiction and things like that. And so why not also ask people about their inner life? Like, if I'm going to ask somebody if they make themselves throw up every day, I'm going to ask them about God, you know. Mm. I know that's a little crass, but it's one of the kind of hard fact realities of psychotherapy in a way, is that it is really about asking hard questions in order to determine what people need. So I always ask everybody, were you raised with a particular religious tradition, and do you have a spiritual practice in your life now? I have no agenda of what their spiritual life might be. For some people, it's yoga, and for other people, it's walking in nature, and for some people, it is organized religion. But that's as important to me as knowing anything else about who they are, because it is, it's a potential resource for their own healing when somebody has depression or anxiety. And often I get people who call me and say, well, I'm not sure if I need spiritual direction or psychotherapy. Like, I'm trying to figure it out. And so that we figure that out together. And oftentimes what people bring to the relationship is similar. Like, they may come with grief or anxiety or the loss of a relationship or the death of a loved one. Or I have a lot of people now I'm working with who are truly bereft about our current global political climate. And so what I do with it, or what we do with it in therapy, is going to be slightly different than what we might do with it in spiritual direction. Like, I'm mostly unlikely to pray with somebody in therapy. I won't say it never happens, because it has happened, but generated from the client. I think I'm a better therapist now, having gone through spiritual direction training. I think we can sit in silence with a little more, it's a different experience of sitting in silence in therapy now, because we talk about what silence is rather than that kind of uncomfortable silence that people often talk about in therapy, where they're like, ugh, the therapist was just sitting there waiting for me to say something. Instead, what people will say more is, I felt like there was all the room in the world for me to get clear about what I was actually feeling. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, if somebody, what they really actually need is psychotherapy in a way that is debilitating in their lives in some way, and that may interfere even with being able to be in spiritual direction without that psychological support, I will say that. So I think that there are a lot of shared qualities. And I also think it's really important to know what the distinctions are. I know there are some folks who don't do them separately. There is my colleague, Estelle Frankel, for example, who's like an amazing writer and teacher. She doesn't see them as separate at all. And she really does it as one offering. I hope I'm representing her accurately. And I know there are other people too. And I think it's really like, it depends on the person. Like, I would it's a huge responsibility, including legal responsibility, to be a licensed mental health provider. And I would not want a spiritual director to have to carry the weight of something that is more than what they feel they have the capacity for, or is their responsibility, because it can be scary.
Yeah. And I imagine that's something you wrestle with a lot in supervision too. So how do people discern that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, my own supervisor also has a master's in counseling. So even though she's never practiced as a therapist, but she has the knowledge and the vocabulary so that she helps me figure out some of those complicated situations that sometimes arise. And I feel really grateful that my training as a therapist has helped me to have some particular tools as a spiritual director that I might not otherwise have. So, like, for example, this is just a very almost like mundane practical thing, but just being a self-employed person and having to talk with people about money, you know, having had years of experience in private practice as a therapist, by the time I finished my spiritual direction training program and I had to have conversations with people about money, I had really explored a lot for myself, like, you know, how does money impact the relationship, and how to talk about money in a way that feels respectful both to the other person and to myself, and what are the complex issues related to money, and what's sacred about money. And even with people I've been working with in spiritual guidance, we've literally like put money, like, you know, dollars on the altar in the room and just sat with it and listened to it and worked with it and talked about it. And you know, most people don't do that kind of stuff. So there's a way in which this is kind of where the hybrid thing comes in. Because I feel like in other fields, like if you are a primary care physician and you also happen to be like board certified as a neurologist, so you have some particular area of expertise in neurology, it's really seen as an asset. You know, it's sort of like people feel like they're getting something extra for that. Or if you're Joni Mitchell and you're like an amazing poet and a singer and you also happen to paint, that's really seen as an asset. But there's some way in which, and I have this in me too, when somebody comes in and they say, oh, and I'm a spiritual director and I'm a therapist, I'm a shaman and I do energy work, and I also used to be a massage therapist. If I was anatomically capable of raising my eyebrow right now, I would do it. You know, like there's a certain raised eyebrow that's like, wait a second, like there's some skepticism or judgment, or I'm not sure what it is that comes up in he, you know. And so I'm curious about how do we change that and talk about it. There isn't a lot of language for it. Like even when people like call themselves a healer, like I wrestle with that word a lot because it feels, for me personally, it has too much ego in it for me. Huh. For me, that may not be true for anybody else. Otherwise, I sort of feel like, no, I don't have a word to, if I could package, take all of what I do and find one word to describe all of it. I just haven't found that yet. So. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm open to ideas if anybody has one, you know? And actually one of the things about social work that was most appealing to me was that there were so many things you could do. Like I didn't just want to be a psychologist. I actually never wanted to do therapy. I wanted to do community organizing. That was really, those my mentors in college were community organizers. And I thought, well, this is great because as a social worker, I can be a community organizer, or I could be a therapist, I can be a lobbyist, I could work in a hospital. I just felt like there's so many options there, and they're all social work. I'm literally just realizing this now as we're having this conversation. Like there was something that really felt right to me about the multifaceted aspect of social work as a profession, and they were all anchored in those core values and ethics and core practices. So like, even if I had never worked with kids before, because my work has been with adults, if I were in a situation in which I needed to do an assessment on a child or advocate for a child, I still would have a basic set of tools and principles and practices that I could do it ethically. I wouldn't necessarily do it well, but it would be ethical. You know, it would be enough to be able to say, okay, now I'm going to help you find the right person for you. And in the spiritual realm, or in the this larger realm of psycho-spiritual healing, the language is really limited. And it's kind of fraught with a lot of, I don't know, just layers of, I don't know, it's hard to find good language for that.
Yeah. Well, I think it's hard to find language. Yeah. For anybody, I mean, I'm resonating with you very deeply right now, because I have been a visual artist my whole life. But you know, the way that you felt sort of conflicted about the term healer, I felt conflicted about the term artist for a lot of, I think for the ego reason, it just felt like a very loaded title, but it also has this sort of typecast walled understanding that I didn't like, which was, well, I'm only being an artist when I'm in the studio, or I'm only being an artist when I'm making paintings. Because I felt like that was too limiting, and I still feel like that's too limiting. That, you know, I can come to, you know, I come to an office every day, and I'm like, well, I have not turned that off. You know, I am doing art today. Like, we are making art right now. Like, we are making meaning and working relationally. And I think that is inherently the role of art, it's a relational object between the artist and the viewer. And it goes both ways. It's not one way. It's not didactic. And so that's something that I hear that in you too, just that, like, you are very uniquely and singularly you, and that you have all of these roles and credentials and expertises that no one of those defines you. And it's the wrestling, I think, between, you know, the constructed self and the true self. That when we present ourselves to people, or when we, you know, it's just like if you're at a wedding or a party and someone's like, oh, Karen, what do you do? And it's like, oh gosh, like, you know, cause I feel that it's like, oh, Matt, what do you do? Well, I'm an artist. Oh, what kind of art do you make? And it's like, lots. Where do you begin? And it's not like it's an annoying question. It gets back to what you were saying, which is just the language is sort of, language doesn't do it justice, right? Like, language is limiting. You have to know somebody. It's
really interesting because, oh my God, I just felt that gut punch when you said that. It's so true. Like, if you're at a social function and somebody says, what do you do? It kind of depends on who the person is and what my mood is at the time. But I usually will fall back on saying I'm a social worker, because it's sort of like, it's like your home room at school, you know, and then I sometimes will also add, oh, well, you know, I used to work in the hospital, but now I'm in private practice and I'm also a spiritual director. And that's usually where I get the Jack Russell Terrier nod, like, spiritual direction, what is that? It's so interesting. And just the way people will say, like, well, what are you? Right. And not just about your vocation, but those questions where people are trying to figure out, like, your gender, your race, or your sexual orientation, or your class, or your, like, you know, the way in which our, and I think this is very much, I can't speak for other cultures, but certainly, like, white Western American culture is like, you're either a this or a that. And there's this whole range in between of, okay, well, this is based on what I see when I see you, I'm assuming you are this, this, and this.
Yeah.
Now, I think for folks who, you know, it's like people don't always know that I'm Jewish by looking at me. A lot of times much earlier in my life, people would literally say, well, what are you? Are you Italian? Are you Greek? Are you Mediterranean? You know, they were sort of trying to figure out, like, what are you? And so I see and experience all these, I could give you many other examples like that, where people are trying to figure out, and we are trying to figure out, what am I? On a similar but slightly different related aspect of this, though, is that I think it's very important to be able to describe what we do, especially as spiritual directors. Like, I literally cringe when I hear people say, oh, it's really hard to describe, you know, like, you, especially if you are trying to invite people to come to your retreats, or you're trying to build your practice as a spiritual director, like, you have to be able to tell people what you do.
Yeah.
It might be different 6 months from now, but I remember, when I was teaching in a spiritual direction training program, and I would literally say to my students, I need you to describe, you have to be able to describe what you do, because otherwise, why is somebody going to want to come to you? And so I go back repeatedly to that page on the SDI website that has all the different definitions of what spiritual direction is from different spiritual traditions, because I might describe it one way for a period of time, and then something changes. Or I'm preparing to give a presentation in a setting that is a different kind of audience, and so I want to be able to use different language, or I just want to learn more about how other people describe this kind of ministry and work. But it's really not, I don't think it's okay to, I don't want to hear people say, oh, it's really hard to describe. Like, I think it's a worthwhile process of exploration to do what is necessary to be able to describe what it is that you do.
Yeah. Yeah. And I tell that to, you know, when I teach art to students, and, you know, I require art statements, and they're like, well, no, I don't need to write about the work, just sort of speaks for itself. And I'm like, oh no, like, you, it's not about telling, you know, the viewer what your work is about. It's about defining for yourself what the work is about.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it makes your practice sharper and the work that you do tighter, and it allows you to more fully have that voice. And, you know, and yet it's like, it's okay to change that down the road. It's not like you're defining yourself for the rest of your life. Like, and I think you understand that language is contingent, and even these containers that we use to sort of define ourselves, the sort of dualistic, this but not that, or this religion and not that one. I hear that in you, that, you know, we use these in this moment, but they're not static, and that they're not forever.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear that too, and you're thinking around this holy hybrid,
mm-hmm.
Person that you are thinking about and wrestling with. And I think you've talked a lot about this holy hybrid person already, because I think that it's you, and I think that it's me, and I think that it's a lot of us. But can you share a little bit about who that person is, the holy hybrid?
The holy hybrid. Yeah. Actually, my whole family and my, like, family of origin, we are all a bunch of holy hybrids. So it's something that feels very familiar and natural to me. My mom, you know, was a poet, and then she became a teacher, and then she was a social justice activist, and then she was a case manager, and she just, you know, like, that phrase, like, reinvented herself, sort of sounds like there's something disingenuous or fake about it, but it wasn't. It was just like, oh, here's another way I can do this. It's like, you have a refrigerator full of food, and you can make lots of different things with it. You don't actually have to eat the same thing every day.
Yeah.
So I'm just also thinking for a minute about a lot of the people that I see in supervision are also hybrids and wrestle with the language of what to call what they do. But there's one aspect of this I just want to lift up for a minute, and that has to do with the feeling of enoughness, of self-worth, and of really seeing oneself as being created in the image of the divine. Because I think a variation on the credential privilege issue has to do with, you know, how many credentials do you need to have to feel enough? And I have a friend, Tara Moore, who is a coach who works in leadership, women's leadership, and she wrote a book called Playing Big. And she's worked with literally hundreds of thousands of women. And one of the things that she has heard consistently over and over is, here are these women, you know, with advanced degrees, CEOs and executive directors and, you know, chancellors of universities and just endless credentials and still not feeling worthy. And so there is something about ministry, I think, in particular, and this hybrid aspect of it as well, that is to really be sure that it isn't about to turn yourself inside out in your own discernment to say, like, where am I in relationship to my own sense of enoughness? Hmm. And what is, you know, what additional training or learning do I want to have in the service of what? Hmm. So that's like a really core piece of it. Kind of going back to my own story, like, without that title of rabbi, or now it's like when sometimes people will call me Dr. Ehrlichman, and I like look around like, is my dad here? You know, not that I'm not proud of that degree, because I am, but I didn't get that degree because I felt like I should, or I had to. It for me was about like, how do I want to have a body of work that integrates all these different parts of who I am under the umbrella of spiritual direction. So it didn't like improve my earning capacity, or like most Jewish people have no idea what a doctor of ministry degree is. Like it was really something I wanted to do for my own sense of like, this is the period at the end of the sentence of a way of integrating all these different parts of kind of what you and I are talking about today, like to weave these pieces together into something. And to be engaged in that ongoing process of self-examination. And this is a spiritual practice of seeing ourselves as enough, especially in a society, for whatever reasons that have to do with racism and sexism and homophobia and all of those things that say you are less than.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think too, that's the, like, seeing that I am enough is also seeing that you are in the image of the divine, that, you know, and that it doesn't look like, and it doesn't look like anybody, but it looks like everybody.
Exactly.
And it looks like you, right? It looks like each of us, you know, in this moment, that is not a one identity, that it is your own singular identity.
And it's one thing to say that. I mean, that is how many times have most people, especially in the Abrahamic faiths, like heard that expression, you're created in the image of God or the image of the divine. But to actually say, and I'm going to really take that in and metabolize it and live my life that way. Like for me, that has to do with how do I listen to people as if I'm listening through God's ears or seeing the world through God's eyes, or that it, I used to say it was like, see the face of God in every person. And yes, that is true. But it also includes see the face of God in every person as if I am looking through the eyes of God, but with humility, right? Not like, yeah, I'm God.
Right.
But to say, like, how do I shed some of those societally imposed ways of seeing and categorizing things and people and the world? And the place it's most challenging for me actually is in the world of politics. You know, to see everybody in the image of divine, including people I think are doing violent, heinous things in the world, is really, really challenging. It's aspirational.
Yeah. I know what you mean. right.
My less polished self.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't think that the spiritual journey is the journey. Like, it's not, I don't think it's ever a place that we arrive at. Like, there are maybe signposts and moments along the way, but you're never done. You're never done. And it, like you said, it needs to be approached from a place of humility. And I think, you know, when we talk about ourselves being in the image of God, I think that that is supposed to drive us to see the image of God in the other. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like, I am God, you know, I am better than all of you. It's like, that's the opposite of what we're talking about. It's that each person that you encounter is in the image of God or the image of the divine. Even people we don't agree with are people that make us uncomfortable, people that we see as other from us. And that's hard work.
It is very hard work. It's good work. And I think it's, I actually think that as spiritual companions, we are in a unique position to provide leadership in that work. And it starts with us doing that work ourselves. I think we never want to hurt or harm somebody else. And yet at the same time, recognizing the limitations of what some of our lived experience has been, and how do we provide opportunities for learning and growing that are organic and interactive. Actually, my first SDI conference, I remember, so I think this was 2003, I want to say. It was in Mundelein, Illinois, outside of Chicago. And there were a lot of people there who had never seen a woman wearing a kippah or a yarmulke before, the little skull cap. And I would say 8 or 10 people approached me in the hallway, in the elevator, whatever, and said, can I ask you a question? And I felt like that was an opportunity. Like, they were saying, I'd never seen a woman. The only thing they'd ever seen was like some Orthodox male rabbi, like in a movie, you know? And so it was an opportunity for me to say, thank you so much for asking. Hmm. And here's a little, yes, like this happens. And now I think it's relatively common, but still it depends. Lots of people who live in more rural areas or areas where there aren't a lot of Jewish folks, or, you know, not a lot of Jewish women in positions of leadership. I remember the first time I saw a woman wearing a yarmulke and a tallis, a prayer shawl, and I sobbed. It was like the most gender transgressive thing I had ever seen. I was just overjoyed. Mm-hmm. But I was also like, wow, you can do that? That's amazing. But I don't think we have spaces. We don't have enough spaces where we can ask the other those questions. Like, why do you wear a hijab? I don't know anything about, you know, or like, why do you wear those beads around your wrist? Or what's the meaning of, when do you wear a prayer shawl? When do you not? Like, where do we get to have those conversations with each other? And I think there are so few places in the world to be in our not knowing, coming from a place of loving respect. And I really think as spiritual companions, we're in a unique position to make those spaces available to people, but we have to do our own work also.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's countercultural to presume that we can offer those questions and ask one another from a place of hospitality, mm-hmm. and like genuine curiosity for getting to know the other, as opposed to like it being antagonistic somehow. And yeah, I that's what we aspire to do, you know, at SDI and at our conferences, to be that public square of spirituality.
Yeah.
But, you know, and it can be messy too, because we end up confronting a lot of things about ourselves that takes some inner work too. So
definitely. I mean, I guess I would say assume messiness.
Yeah.
And be prepared. And this is what we are doing. We are in the mess together. So if we try to like sugarcoat and sanitize everything, I don't mean just like say whatever you think without any filter, but just to say, let's acknowledge this is uncomfortable. this is going to be messy. We're going to like step on each other's toes. We might say the wrong thing. How do we want to hold that together?
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful.
Or even for people to have the freedom to say, I don't have it today. You know, like I just cannot deal with one more ignorant person, you know, or like I feel tapped out, or, you know, I feel like I'm being tokenized or whatever. I think for folks to have the freedom to say, I'm opting out right now. And then for other people to say, okay, I'm going to step up today.
Yeah. Or allow people to tap out. Like, mm-hmm. Of course, you know, and to not be necessarily offended by that, but to learn from it.
Definitely.
You know, oh, well, how can we do that differently? Like, we're all learning this stuff together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Karen describes the multifaceted, ongoing process of weaving the pieces of our lives into something, and ultimately the spiritual practice of seeing yourself as enough. This is a form of self-compassion or self-care. It also requires us to see others, or the other, as equally enough, that they too are sacred. I wonder too if spiritual companionship is inherently multifaceted, as we listen and respond to one another's stories, meeting the spiritual needs of the person we are with, and making something new right in that moment of connection. Also, Karen mentioned the webpage that describes what spiritual direction is and that she finds herself referencing it regularly. That's on our website, sdiworld.org/seekers. Or you can just go to sdiworld.org and scroll down to the bottom of the page and find the big button that says seekers and click that, and you will find many, many resources about what it means to be a spiritual companion or spiritual director, or how to find a spiritual director. This is Matt Whitney with Spiritual Directors International. Thanks again for listening. Your time and your presence here are deeply appreciated. If you liked this show and would like us to continue making them, please do subscribe now while it's fresh on your mind. Also, we would love to hear from you, so please feel free to send in your comments and suggestions to the email address podcast@sdiworld.org. To learn more about spiritual companionship and ways that you can plug in and join our community, visit us at our website at www.sdiworld.org. Thank you. Blessings and peace on your day, and may you share blessings and peace to others.